Accession number 20590, Reel 4.
Norman Mitchell, Reel 4. So you were...
I was then transferred to 3 Troop.
You were with the water carrier for how long in Normandy?
Until the end of the Falaise Gap.
Right, okay. So tell me from when you started on the water carrier in Normandy. You know, what was going on exactly and what did you see? Where did you go?
Well, it was mainly static, you see. This static area, this hill 112 that we're holding, prior to the breakout, which was crossing the River Orne, I think, was the first stage of this business of pushing the Germans back towards Falaise. And there was this triangle, Falaise, Argentan and Trun. Now, we knew what was happening. The Americans were breaking out from farther down, and whilst we were holding, I don't think the Americans agree with us on this, but we were holding the bulk of the German armour at that end, and the Americans couldn't understand why we weren't making the same progress as they were.
Right.
Well, they were purely and simply were advancing on a far wider front, and therefore the defences there were nowhere near as strong as they were at our end of the line.
Right. Okay. So you're saying you were holding that part. So what exactly was going on day to day? I mean, what in the way of action? What could you hear?
Well, obviously there was artillery fire. We were under fire from artillery and mortars occasionally. And when you went up to the front, of course, you had to be off. Well, you know, you had to be pretty careful with that steel helmet on and everything else, you know.
So you were driving your water.
Driving the water cup into the We obviously had precaution. We had sandbags on the base of under the seat and that sort of thing, in case, just to stop if anything was coming up. It might have saved you. I don't think it would, but you felt confident that it would, you know. And
so you were going right up to the front line.
Right at the front. Oh yeah, right at the front. Yeah, and with water supplies and that sort of thing.
What was that like? What could you see?
Oh, it was pretty air raising, but they always had the lads. Given they do, they always had. There was always a slit trench just below the, well, where they could come over, and they had a slit trench there for me and my compatriot to jump in if anything started coming over. Yeah.
So when you got up there, what would you do?
Well, they would know. They would have advance notice that we were on the way with the ammunition went first, of course. Can't do without that. And then the food and the water would come more or less at the same time. That could be staggered if things were pretty hot up there. Well, then okay, you'd have to, you know, only one at a time, you know.
And you would drive up into where?
Well, usually a place back from the actual front trenches. You know, there's usually a copse, a wood, or something like that. If at all possible, you drive into there, and being quite obscure, you know.
Right, and you pump your water.
Then they would come and fill their cans with water. And they'd come and fill up with their water, because they had special cans for water, the jerry cans, yeah. And they would come fill them up, and then as soon as everybody was done, you drive back, but not very quickly.
Right, why not?
Because of the dust.
Right. So what was the weather like?
Hot. Hot, yes. It really was in those early July, yeah. And so the roads were all dusty, and dust brings shells.
So
the lovely thing which the much maligned military police put a sign up just before you coming up the front line, it said, "In luck we believe, in God we trust, but the Hun still shoots at a cloud of dust. Slow down." And eventually what they did along that road, it got so bad that they put a water truck from another unit with the taps open to keep the dust down. Yeah. Thank God it wasn't mine. But these signs, yeah.
A boring job.
Yeah, and then all these signs appear on the front. You'd be amazed, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they put up sort of officially, you know.
Oh, yeah, these were painted. All painted, yes. And what was the other one? Yeah. The Hun stonking is artillery fire. A stonk is a... Yeah. The Hun stonks at 4:15. It is now 4:10. run for your hole. These things will appear in bright painted, yeah. Yeah, absolutely wonderful. Yeah.
When you're
in those things, yeah.
So what did you see of the casualties on both sides? I mean,
well, at that stage, whilst I would had the water shot, I didn't see a lot. I knew a lot that were being wounded or killed and that sort of thing at various places, but one didn't see any of it. And even with when all these lads were from about the 15th of August on, 14th of August, yeah, there's old Tommy Wood that I was telling about, he got killed, and Eddie Crewe and all these Sergeant Pritchard and Jones and all of them. There's a whole load right the way down through to the 18th. Mm. You can see how many we lost. Mm. And that was more or less out of the one squadron. Mm. Mm.
But at this stage, while you were driving the water truck, you had little knowledge of that, yes?
Oh, I knew it was... Oh, yes, we knew it.
Yeah.
That's when you go up to the supply, oh, so-and-so wasn't there, and you knew it happened anyway.
Mm. Were the Padres, you had a Padre?
We had a Padre, Harry Smith, yeah. Harry Smith, great character. And during this period in the Falaise job, he was down, obviously, burying casualties. And he went down to bury a lot of our fellas with some people that were, lads like myself, would go down and dig. And having got our own people buried, then he said, look, well, he said, hang on, chaps, he said, I just spotted three Germans down here. He said, I'll just go down and prepare them. Well, he went to prepare them, and they were booby-trapped. And he went up with it, yeah. Well, he's there, casually, yeah. Mm. He was killed right there and then, yeah. Mm. Very sad.
How was he regarded? I mean, did people
respect
him?
Oh, yeah. I remember him saying, before we went out, and some of because when the Padres are, of course, all the officers go. You know that, do you? Yeah. And he can say what he likes. And somebody got up and said, why is it we got to have a church parade? He said, well, the one reason is that you'd be too, if you had to volunteer, you'd be too bloody lazy to come. And that was his exact expression. And he's quite right. But he really was very nice, very pleasant guy.
So he was the sort of official face of religion?
He was the official face of religion,
were,
yeah.
Were there people who were religious? Carried a Bible into battle or whatever, you know.
No, one or two, old Tommy Cox, I remember, very much that way inclined. I wasn't without faith, help me. I said I was completely committed at those stages, not like I was in the later life, but as one powder he said, you'll never find an atheist on a battlefield. And I believe him.
So the Padre was an integral part of...
Oh, he was, yeah. Yes. Now, the one that came after him, whose name I can't remember, he would come up as well and hold little services in certain parts, especially when, you'd lost quite a few people. Hold small services. About perhaps 20 or 30 of you there. Have a little service there. Sing the... what we used to call the reconnaissance corps signature hymn, oft in danger, oft in woe, onward Christians, onward go. We consider that the reconnaissance battle hymn, yeah.
Okay, so you landed in, do you remember what date in July?
I think it's about the 24th, I think, of July we landed.
So how long were you on the water carriers after that?
Up until August. Until about August the
14th. Right, okay.
Or thereabouts, yeah.
So how did you come to switch from the water carrier to the armoured car?
Well, they knew I was trained, and that was it. And said, right...
You're replacing a casualty?
Yeah.
So, how many people in an armoured car?
Three people in an armoured car. You got the driver, you got the gunner, wireless operator, and the commander.
Right. So, what were you doing?
I was wireless gunner to start with. But I could drive. You've got to be able to do any of it, you see. Yeah.
So you were sent to this. So who were you in the car then, with?
Our crew was a Sergeant Jerry Pritchard, and the driver was Mick Ladbury. Pritchard came from He was, as I say, like myself, quite well educated. And but Mick Ladbury was he came from Gillingham, and he was a grocery assistant in the Gillingham Co-op. Nice guy, very nice guy, Mick. Yeah. And we were together right through until the end of the war.
Right, you were
like
blessed, lucky.
Lucky, lucky be a guardian angel, yeah. Right.
So, when you first joined this car, big change in,
yep.
in your
big
life.
Change, yeah.
So how did it feel and what did you do at first?
I don't know. I suppose I looked upon it as inevitable. Having seen all the cars, you see, because what happened as well, see, they had so many cars, at the same time, the 59th Division was disbanded for some reason we never found out. And so, of course, their recce regiment was disbanded. So a lot of casualty replacements came from them. And that was where this Mick Ladbury, our driver, came from. He came from the 59th into us. Jerry Pritchard was already in C Squadron. And he was lucky when all this Shemozzle was going on, he escaped. He got out of it. I don't know how or when, but yeah, nice guy.
So what were you actually?
Well, then your job then after that, once you started after the valet's job, of course, was the chase across France.
Right. So you weren't actually in the armoured car for valets.
Not for valets. No. I didn't come in until after that. Right, I didn't. Okay. I was an armoured car crew until afterwards.
Right. Okay. So tell me what.
And then we proceeded then under chasing the Germans out, keeping them going. Right the way across France.
So tell me about some actual contact you had with them, some skirmishes or whatever.
Well, the way you operated, the way we operated then in the Welsh, you had five armoured cars, one light armoured car, three heavy armoured cars, and another light armoured car. Now, the front troop was a light and a heavy. The command vehicle was a heavy armoured car. And then at the back, you had another heavy and the light reconnaissance car bringing up the rear. And the idea, the way you make first contact is to drive the light armoured car with the heavier car at some distance away. The light armoured car would go up and observe and make decisions as to whether there's anything. And then he'd move on. The heavy armoured car would then come up and take his place. And so you'd leapfrog until he met something.
And which one were you in?
I was in the heavy. In the heavy armoured car support, yeah.
Tell me about
the front armoured car was the one most vulnerable. Mm. Yeah. If he was unlucky and got hit, that was it. But then your then immediate action then was to let... the first immediate action in those circumstances was to lay smoke canisters down, and then go up and find out what's happened. Get them out if you could, if they were still alive, or if they wouldn't get them out, and that was it. And then call up the rest of the troop to take steps to... protect us that were going up to help, yeah.
Right, okay. Can you remember any particular engagements?
I think in the one that springs to mind most of all was in a village called Cramont. It's in mid France, whereby we drove into the village at dusk. It was just getting dusk. And the light armoured car went in first and pulled up dramatically and called us up. And there was a column of German artillery loaded, ready to move out. And we took the lot. We took the lot of them prisoner.
You
used to fight
them?
Well, they were in no position. We lost their officer. The officer, the old major, he nipped off. All the others weren't awfully interested in fighting, so we got more down, disarmed them, and put their vehicles off the road, the gun, everything, and the other stuff there. I think they put three guns, three artillery, three 88s there. And I suppose there must have been, 60 or 70 of them, maybe more, I don't know, I didn't bother to count them. We were all concerned as to whether anybody was going to come up and... So what we did with them, we disarmed them and then put them in the school, and the local Mackie, local resistance people came out. Can we help? There were about a dozen of them. We said, yeah, you can help, yeah. Keep them in there. Now, they're all armed to the teeth, these fellas, you know. And you're like, no, we want to fight. No, no fighting. We'll do the fighting. You just keep them in there until tomorrow. And that was it.
And then you would report back on the radio.
We report back on the radio as to what happened and then hope we'd be relieved, but we weren't. What had happened was that after we got through, the armoured car got through, Germans counterattacked farther down behind us and had cut the road behind. So we were there in this village of Cremon with these Jerry's in the school, and 15 of us with 5 armoured cars, you know, and at night, I mean, you can't see a lot from an armoured car at night. Unlike now, yeah. When you got your
scary,
then, yeah. So well, you know, you just put the armored cars away and then come out with all the, because an armored car troop has got tremendous firepower. In addition to having the 7.92 Beza in the turret and the main gun, you've also got a Bren gun and also a couple of Stens. So in actual fact, your firepower is quite. So you come out and secure the entrance of the villages, hoping that if anybody came through, you could stop them.
Mm. What state was the village in? How big was it? Had it been damaged?
No. No, it hadn't been damaged. No, it was quite a good state. We heard, by the following morning, that the Germans had retreated from behind us. And so we went in, and the lady in the cafe there cooked us breakfast. First fresh eggs we'd had since we'd been in France, I think, yeah. Yeah, she fried eggs and everything else. That's
she was pleased to see you.
Oh, Jay Rail with the moon, yeah. Mm. And then, of course, when we pulled out, that was a sad day. And, of course, we had to take the Germans with us.
Mm. So what, did you have them marching?
No. We don't want to march. Put them in the car. We don't want to march with them. Put them in the lorries. Put them in their lorries and have an armoured car between each one.
And you took them where?
Took them back to squad, back to the squadron, which is the headquarters down the road, and they were then went back to regiment, the regimental headquarters, where they were, you know, briefed and documented, and that was it, yeah.
So were any shots fired in
all
that?
No. Not one.
Excellent.
It's a way to do it. It's a way to do it, was, yeah. But I don't know, never done anything quite like that, yeah.
So you must have had other contact with the enemy, which was...
Oh, yeah, at various stages, you know. Anything fluid like that, the main things that the Germans did was to put roadblocks up to slow you down. So there was a lot of business of tow ropes on trees and dragging them out of the armoured car so that you could go on. But and then you meet the odd straggler here and there and pick him up and take him on with you so far and then drop him off with a... If you pass the infantry, let them have him, you know, because we didn't want him.
So, I mean, when did you first fire from your armoured car? You know?
Oh, various times. I mean, you fire shots into places with the idea that you might get return fire, and then you know there's anybody there.
So, can you think of an instant when you... With an
Across the bridge, there was a bridge being built across one of the rivers there, and the engineers were getting a bit of trouble from snipers, and so they called the armoured cars up, and it sorted them out. I forget, I don't know what the river was, you know, so much of it, in actual fact. Yeah.
So, did you have much of an idea where you were?
Oh, yeah. The maps
and
weren't.
You knew how the line was going.
The line was going, where everybody else was, and knew what, if you were out on the. A lot of work for Recce was involved in maintaining contact between the two divisions. You know, you get the gap. Well, there shouldn't be a gap. You should have a reconnaissance unit in there, just keeping track of what's going on, you know. That was done, and you knew who was on your left, or if you were on the other flank, who was on your right. And you knew the units that were operating. Usually, occasionally it went wrong. Bad liaison and things like that, you know. But generally speaking, you knew who was... operating where, what was happening, and you knew, I mean, the maps weren't all that accurate, you know, the church was always on, if there was a church and it was on that side of the road, it could be on t'other, you know, things like that, and crossroads may not be exactly where they were, it might be a bit farther on, or a bit short, or they may not be there at all.
So, can you remember the route you took?
What are you looking in there?
Yeah, right, okay. So... Can you remember any other particular...
I mean, there's so much, you know, that happened.
You were doing this, I mean, every day.
Oh, yeah.
It just went on.
It went on and on and on, yeah. You kind of come out occasionally for a rest, you know. I mean, you didn't go on, you know, week in, week out, week in, week out. I mean, you eventually... Well, you give it, because, I mean, whilst you were operating this reconnaissance job during the day, you couldn't do it at night because you couldn't see. So you'd come back into a... harbour, but then of course you can't guard that overnight, you see, so you're on stag, as you used to call it, you know, two on, four off, or one on, two off, depending on what the weather was like.
Right, so weather was...
You get two of you on guarding the harbour, yeah. Mm. If it was raining cats and dogs, you'd do an hour, but if it was fine, you'd do two, and then you've got a good old 4 hour, hopefully a good 4 hour skip after, you see.
So the weather was reasonably kind.
Reasonably kind, yeah. Those days, yeah. The next thing after that, village there of Cramont in mid France, though the rush then up to Lille in northern France, and we literally outstripped the, well, we could move, you know, and got up through there with no resistance at all, and got into the outskirts of Lille at the outskirts called Haubedin, and it was night, so we left the armoured cars out under guard, and about half a dozen of us waiting on foot to see what was to find out the form, as the saying went. And we got in there, and there was nobody around. We made contact with the underground people there, who wanted to bring everybody out and celebrate liberation, and we said, no, you don't dare. We've only got five armoured cars here and a few more over yonder. And if you bring the whole lot out and the Germans come back and counterattack, we shan't be able to do anything, but we have to withdraw until the divisional infantry arrive and they can make a proper battle of it.
So
we persuaded them not to.
So when you arrived there, how did you find the Mackie?
Well, there's always somebody about, somebody wandering around, you know, and my French was quite good in those days.
Yeah. What would you
say? Didn't know. No, I don't know. And the biggest shock to them was that we were Brits. We were English.
So they didn't know who it was.
They didn't know that we were coming. They didn't until, well, they hear what was coming on, and they knew that something was happening because the Germans had pulled out, you see. Mm. We didn't have to assault Lille. They pulled out.
Do you remember that conversation with that first person you met?
Oh, not really.
Yeah.
Not really, no.
Yeah. What were the
Mackie
like? I mean, you could rely on their...
They were typical French, awfully excitable, and they had all sorts of loads of Germans parked up somewhere where they could take us to. We could take them prisoner, but they were never there. Their report on German troop movements was normally two or three days adrift, you know.
What did you think about their abilities?
They were very useful. They were useful. But they could, in actual fact, be, how can you say, a little bit too keen. Yeah.
So not always reliable.
Not 100%, no. But they were useful. I mean, they did us a lot of good. I mean, the information they gave us at certain times were marvellous.
What state was Lille in? It had been occupied.
We went in the following morning and it was all hell let loose. I have never seen scenes of liberation. I mean, the villages, yeah, you go through, you get greeted and all sorts of things. But the outskirts of Lille, and we went in there, was an absolute riot. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. Where they got all the drink from, I don't know. They'd obviously stored it. And we were all invited into houses because, you know, to wash and shave. Normally wash and shave in the open, you see, boil your own water. Oh no, come in. Inside, yeah. And
what were the houses like? I mean, did you get an impression of how they were living?
I think they weren't too badly off, in actual fact. They did strike us as being that badly off anyway. I remember I took my washing kit in, and in those days we used to have perhaps you wouldn't remember Lifebuoy toilet soap, would you? Yeah, can't use that, throw that away. Have some good soap. the real McCoy, they'd obviously say. And you see, even liberating the villages, they come through, and It's amazing what they had stored down the end of the garden. Drink, you know, cognac, all that sort of thing, you know. That was, but Leo, had to be seen to be believed. It couldn't get in. We couldn't move. We couldn't move. Once it got in there, that was it, yeah. We had a Roman Catholic priest join us, whose name I don't know. Marvellous guy. He wanted to stay with us. He wanted to come with you. No. He said, don't get three of us in here. There's no room for another, you know. But,
Well, they were pleased.
Oh,
they
were British.
Absolutely. I mean, was that important?
People in northern France and Belgium, yeah. The people in Normandy, I think, weren't quite so happy with us. I mean, let's be frank, we'd knocked their place about a bit. And they weren't terribly happy to have. They were glad to see us go. And I can understand it. Certainly, a lot of the farmers stayed, you know. As I remember in those early stages there, when I still had the water truck, I used to go around buying butter from the farms. You can buy, they made their own butter, you know, something. And we're glad to sell it, because otherwise it just rot. Oh, yeah, the little place called Bretville l'Orgueilleuse. I used to go into the farm there, young dairy maid in there. Used to go in there every day. Oh, bonjour, monsieur. Yeah, yeah. Lovely, beautiful. Buying their butter. And then the odd cafe that was open, you could get Calvados at 15 francs a shot.
So Lille, the life
would
be very different then.
Lille, yeah, it was totally different.
But they suffered under the Germans.
I don't think they did so badly. I don't think they did. They did that badly, but there we are. Whoops.
Yeah, my tape can't see it, but you can talk me through it. So.
That's my armoured car there.
Oh, right.
With all the people on it, yeah. Climbing all over it, yeah. You couldn't get near it.
Liberation of Lille, yeah. 1944. Yeah. Photograph on page 73 of the Welsh spearhead. So that's actually your armoured car.
That's my armoured car there, yeah.
So, I mean, did you feel like a liberating sort?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know.
You felt good. Made you feel that what you were doing was worthwhile. When you could see that sort of greeting, yeah. And there we are. We suffered. As I say, we suffered no casualties.
And so from Lille?
The final shot from Lille is this last little sentence here from Coburn from Welsh Spearhead. He said that the war diary records a task which it was thought didn't need the whole division to do. We did Lille in holiday mood. It better be left to the individual reminiscences of those who were there. Suffice it to say that much liberation spirit was experienced and drunk.
Right. So Lille was a thoroughly good experience.
Oh, it's fabulous, yeah. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. And after Lille, where did you
go? We then went on into Belgium, where we were also welcomed with open arms, yeah.
Yeah. So this was, I mean, not quite a victory parade, but I mean, did you meet a lot of resistance?
Going into Belgium, yeah, there was only isolated bits here and there where they'd hold a bridge and, you know, things like that, and then you'd have to work out how to capture the bridge and then go on beyond, you know, or if the bridge was, and the other thing, of course, reconnaissance work for bridges that were blown, and then you could radio back to say that there was this river or stream which was somebody west of it. The width and so on, so engineers could then order up all the gear to sling a bridge across. Yeah.
Can you remember some particular bridges?
Not really. Okay. No.
Right, we'll stop there. This is Norman Mitchell, end of reel 4.